10%. We improved our efficiency quite remarkably over a period of time. Efficiency defined in terms of the amount of energy used per dollar of GDP produced, or the amount of material used, resources used per dollar of GDP produced. 2% a year is pretty good. Over a period of 30 years, it added up to a very substantial amount. Between 1970 and 2000, we saw improvements in many cases of 40 or more percent in terms of efficiency, both in terms of material and energy efficiency. But that was exceeded by economic growth. So the result was, as you can see in the last point there, that the total environmental impact, if we want to look at it in terms of something like carbon dioxide, increased with growth. But because we got rid of all the visible problems, the visible pollution in our streams and our rivers and our lakes, and the pollution in our air over our cities, we didn't see the extra environmental load that we were putting on the environment and on the planet. In a sense, what we did is we transferred that load beyond the horizon in time and space. We increased our carbon dioxide output, and currently, the people who are going to pay that price are elsewhere on the planet, or in the future, our children and children's children. Why is it that we're so deeply committed to growth? Well, here we come to some pretty profound cultural issues, I think. And I would say it's because we have internalized in our cultures and our societies these four equivalencies. And we've internalized them in significant part because they're actually backed by a fair amount of evidence. Growth equals solvency. After the Second World War, all the deeply indebted countries who'd fought that war grew out of their debt. We want to grow out of our household debt. If our households become wealthier over time, the debt becomes a smaller proportion. Even if it's a constant absolute amount, it becomes a smaller proportion of the overall household income. We maintain the solvency, the putative solvency of our pension funds by assuming that those pension funds will be able to meet the obligations of those pension funds or the pension commitments because our economies are going to grow in the future and we'll be able to make bigger contributions to those pension funds. In all kinds of ways, both explicitly and implicitly, we associate growth with maintaining solvency over time. We associate growth with freedom. This is something that probably goes back as far as the Renaissance with the development of notions of progress and became much clearer during the Enlightenment. And there's now very strong arguments made by some conservative economists, such as Benjamin Friedman at Harvard University, to suggest that the only way we can be truly free is to live within societies that have continual economic growth. We equate growth with happiness because there's an association in our minds between wealth and happiness. You get wealthier, you're happier. Now, you might know that there's quite a big argument about that back and forth, and the evidence is interesting and complex. There's enough evidence to suggest that there is, especially at lower incomes, a very strong correlation between wealth and happiness. Certainly up to the level of somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 per year per capita. And I think the most powerful argument in favor of growth is actually the last equivalency, which is growth equaling peace. That's a lesson that we learned in the 1930s. We learned that when you have an economic collapse, you get the rise of political extremism, and you get horrible outcomes like the Second World War. And John Maynard Keynes came along and gave us tools to maintain perpetual economic growth. How ironic that the economists regarded by many people on the left as the icon of economists actually gave us the tools to destroy the world environment. And you know right now, in this economic crisis, the central bankers of the world and the policymakers of the world are using every single Keynesian tool in their toolkit to try to sustain consumption. How ironic it is in a world right now that the only way we can reduce humankind's load on the natural environment is to have an economic collapse. And we need to figure out an alternative. And we need to figure out an alternative that actually addresses these four issues. This is cultural in the sense that these are deeply embedded assumptions, but they're assumptions backed by enough empirical evidence and enough historical experience that when we move, as we will this century, to a steady state economy, we need to know where we're going. And we need to try to have a world in which we can maintain our freedoms and maintain our peace, even though we don't grow. Now, this is really important. There are about 50% of the world's population that lives on $2 a day or less. For them, economic growth is absolutely central and essential. It can mean the difference between life and death. If we live in a steady state economy, that doesn't mean everybody's not growing. It means fundamentally there has to be a redistribution of some kind, of opportunity and wealth within the world economy. That means the climate problem, because it's linked to growth, is fundamentally a problem of equity in this world, something that never gets discussed. It's a problem ultimately about the enormous gaps between rich and poor. John Kenneth Galbraith, the late American economist, said that growth is the best lubricant between rich and poor. If we have a global economy that stops growing, perhaps because of the increasing damage caused by climate change and energy scarcity later this century, you can guarantee that rich and poor will be at each other's throats within our societies and around the world. So this is an enormously important challenge. What's the alternative? Well, the alternative will have to involve, in part, the notion of resilience. And my work here is grounded very much in the ideas of Buzz Halling, an ecologist. Rather than emphasizing growth, I would argue that we need to emphasize this concept of resilience, which is a situation in which you're able to withstand shocks of various kinds without catastrophic failure. Resilient peoples, institutions, and societies can withstand shocks without catastrophic failure. And I would argue that in a complex, tightly coupled world exhibiting increasingly frequent and severe system shock, that the balance of economic and social investment shouldn't go towards increasing efficiency / productivity / growth, but should shift from those things towards increasing resilience. Because we're going to have a lot of instabilities and crises in the future, and if we're going to be able to use those productively to produce the kind of deep change in behaviors, cultures, and technologies, we have to make sure that things don't fall apart at the same time. Resilience is an essential feature of a world that's able to adjust effectively to crisis and exploit the opportunity of crisis. I won't go into detail about what it means, but it means things like this: loosening coupling in our systems, increasing redundancy of critical components. You can talk about your food systems, your energy systems, your world economy, increasing the diversity of entities across those systems, decentralizing. Decentralizing is very important because it allows for what Buzz Halling usefully calls safe fail experimentation. Experimentation that can take place at the local level, energy production, food production, what have you, healthcare provision. And if something doesn't work there, you don't have a cascading failure across the whole society. And we're getting pretty used to cascading failures, since that's exactly what we've seen in the world economy. It's like a row of dominoes falling over. And that's what happens in systems that are very tightly coupled. And all of these things that are mentioned in this list allow us to maximize flexibility. When we don't really know what's going to happen because we're in a world of unknown unknowns, it's important to be as flexible as possible so that we can respond in a whole variety of ways to new contingencies. I'd also argue, this is my last point on the economic transition, that there is, and this is quite controversial, this kind of inverted U relationship between connectivity and resilience. I disagreed with the inverted U we saw with the environmental Kuznets curve, but here I think this is quite accurate. That within a complex system, resilience, the capacity to withstand catastrophic shock, can increase up to a certain extent as there's connectivity in the system. In a food system, for instance, you don't want all the food-producing regions to be disconnected from each other. There needs to be some connection so that if there's a disease or a drought in one place, it can reach out to the rest of the network and draw food from that food system, that food network. But beyond a certain point, represented by the top of that U, you start to get increasing risks of that domino falling over effect of cascading failures. And you actually reduce your resilience the more connected you are. This is an argument that is a pretty profound critique, I think, of the dominant notions of globalization, of rising interconnectivity, because the deep cultural presumption of the last two or three decades, I think, across at least rich developed countries, has been that the more connectivity we have, the better off we are. And I would suggest that we're way too far up that connectivity continuum right now. And we are seeing the negative results in the form of things like this recent economic crisis. I'm going to spend less time on both the political and normative transitions. I don't have quite as much to say. But I think that, nonetheless, these are, in many respects, perhaps equally important. One of the striking things about humankind is that as you add more and more of us together into larger and larger groups, we seem to behave more and more stupidly. And in fact, at the level of the whole world, the planet, the population of the planet, we seem to have the intelligence of something like a population of protozoa in a petri dish. You know, we're gobbling up all our resources and pooping up our environment and poisoning ourselves. That's not always the case. We can see certain circumstances in which the larger the collectivity of human beings, the smarter the overall behavior, where you get that emergent phenomenon of the whole being more than the sum of the parts. We can see it sometimes in the markets, in market behavior. We can see it in some behaviors on the World Wide Web and the Internet. Wikipedia, for example, is a remarkable product of the interaction of a whole bunch of people, none of whom knows even a tiny fraction of everything that's represented in that encyclopedia. So I think one of the deep challenges, it's a cultural and an institutional challenge of these coming decades, is to create more effective democracy, maybe not the formal procedural democracy that we're so familiar with in Western societies, but real democracy at the level of our communities. For a variety of reasons, I don't think that we're actually going to be able to address these problems effectively, climate change problems, unless we can mobilize people democratically. I suggest that one of the ways that we might do this is by using some of the things that we've learned in the open source movement, the movement that has produced, for instance, Wikipedia, to apply some of those principles in solving our large-scale environmental, climate, economic, and social problems. There are all kinds of challenges as to whether this would be possible. But somehow we need to create communities that are smarter than the sum of their parts, rather than stupider than the sum of their parts. The real political challenge here is this. We need democratic mobilization to increase the power of our publics relative to the special interests that are blocking change. Whatever economy and political and social system you're looking at, when you search out why we aren't making progress on climate change, it's true in Canada, for instance, with the tar sands. Those tar sands companies reach right into the federal cabinet of our country. And the reason that Canada has an abysmal national policy on climate change is because politicians in Ottawa don't have the capacity to push back against those tar sands companies and other energy interests in Alberta. That's the fundamental reason. And it's true, this kind of thing is true all over the world. The only way I can see that we can address that challenge is through a reinvigoration of democracy, getting beyond purely procedural democracy, and perhaps engaging in some kind of open architecture form of democratic community. Now, here's one thing that gives me a little bit of hope. At the very time when our species is facing one of the biggest challenges that's ever faced, perhaps the biggest challenge that's ever faced in its history, we happen to have in place on this planet a rudimentary architecture for species-wide democracy, a technological infrastructure for species-wide democracy. But we don't use it effectively. Outside of things like Wikipedia, it seems like the internet, for the most part, is just a venue for a cacophony of narcissism. We blog at each other, and we bully each other, and we flame, and everybody isn't creating anything larger than the sum of the parts. I think that can be changed, but it's going to require some deep rethinking of what our political, what forms of political engagement citizens can engage in our societies. Now, open architecture democracy is going to have these fundamental challenges. Any ideas that are put forward are solutions to problems that are suggested. There are going to be a multitude of them within any kind of democratic space. Somehow we have to winnow those ideas down to a few that make some sense for further conversation. We need to improve them over time. That's the idea of accumulation. Wikipedia, interestingly enough, does that very well. We need the process to not be hijacked by special interests that are extremely vocal. And most fundamentally, we need to manage experts. Now, I guess I qualify as something of an expert, and there are many experts in this room. But I'm increasingly convinced that unless the general public is an integral part of the process of solving these problems, they probably won't get solved. So experts need to contribute ideas and knowledge, listen very carefully, but not stand in the way or occlude debate in any way. And unfortunately, that seems to happen too often. If this climate change and energy problem remains fundamentally a technocratic problem addressed by experts, it's not going to be solved. And before I leave this political transition aside, let me just tell you a very quick story. During the height of the Cold War in the early 1960s, it looked like a fundamentally intractable problem. Maybe it looked a lot like the climate change problem right now. And then there was a mother in Connecticut, and she read a newspaper story about some recent scientific research. And it said, that research said that strontium-90 from testing of nuclear weapons in the atmosphere by the United States and the Soviet Union was accumulating in cow's milk and was accumulating in mother's milk and was increasing the likelihood of leukemia in children. And this mother, who had a young child who's nursing, said, I'm potentially killing my child. And she was outraged by that. So she started a little organization in her community, and then that expanded beyond her community, and this was all before the age of the internet. And within a few months, hundreds of thousands of mothers were involved around the world, from the United States to Europe to the Soviet Union. And within a year, the United States and the Soviet Union had signed the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which put all testing underground. Not a perfect solution by any means, but the first major step in addressing the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union. And the Pugwash movement, as a result of the Bertrand Russell Albert Einstein Manifesto, was directly involved in the Partial Test Ban Treaty. So don't think that people, individuals, even those who would seem to be as marginal as isolated housewives in the early 1960s, can't actually mobilize large numbers of people. It's vastly easier now, given the capabilities of technology we have. Now, finally, the normative transition. I think we need, and this in some respects is the deepest cultural shift, to shift our common understanding of value and expand the scope of what we mean by we. I generally have decided, or after thinking about this a lot, have come to the conclusion that there are three fundamental categories of value that human beings use. What I would call simple preferences or utilities. These are simple likes or dislikes, like I like vanilla ice cream more than chocolate ice cream. The kind of notion of value that economists use right now. Moral values or oughts that relate to issues of fairness between people principally, across space and time, issues of distributive justice. And then finally, a kind of value that gets discussed much less. This would be what you might call existential or spiritual values. These relate to what we regard as bringing meaning into our lives, what our notion of the good life is, what we think of as the relationship between ourselves and human beings and the cosmos, the big why questions that we all ask when we're young, but sometime around 10 years old, and I'm sure this is true in every society around the world, we get the feeling from the expressions on the faces of adults whom we're asking these questions that we just shouldn't bother because they just are too disruptive and rather annoying. And the adults say instead, well, go to your local religious institution, go to your local church or mosque or synagogue, and you'll find some answers there. But you walk in the door of your local church or mosque or synagogue, and you're not given a place to think about these issues. Instead, you're given a creed. You're told what to think. And as a result, in our even liberal societies, we don't actually spend a lot of time talking about moral values and even less talking about existential or spiritual values. And yet, we aren't going to be able to address climate change and energy problems unless we come up with some rough consensus over what the good life is and what we want as a good life for our children and grandchildren. In the absence of that conversation, generally in our societies, about moral values and existential values and spiritual values, the utilitarian values fill up all the space. And we deal with our existential angst by going to the mall and shopping. Really. And I think this is a fundamental challenge that we face now. That ultimately these climate and energy problems come down to what we think would be a good life in a spiritual and moral way for our children and our grandchildren. And trying to achieve some kind of agreement across the societies around the world. And then that leads me to my final point, which is about expanding the scope of the we, of our notion of collective identity, of community. Now, Anatole Rapoport was one of the 20th century's great mathematical psychologists, and he was a mentor of mine. He was at the University of Toronto when I was a young faculty member there. And in my last lunch with him, he said this to me. The moral development of a civilization is measured by the breadth of its sense of community. And that statement has stayed with me for many years now. And I think it's profoundly true. And just to conclude, I'd like to say something a little bit more personal. My wife and I, Sarah and I, have two young children. We have a 4-year-old little boy and a 1-year-old little girl. And I can say that those children are a source of both enormous worry and enormous hope. They're a source of worry and concern because they are the most intimate connection to the future imaginable. Every time I look at Ben and Kate, it's like I'm looking through a window 80 years into the future. Because of the uncertainty inherent in these systems we're dealing with, I don't really know what that future looks like. But I know enough to be very worried and to be concerned that this may be one of the first generations of young people that will live substantially worse off in the wealthy countries of the world than previous generations. They're also a source of great hope, though, and this partly comes from my experience traveling around the world. I've traveled in 60 countries or so extensively in several dozen. And I've talked to people all around the world about their concerns, as one does when one travels. And one thing I have learned across all the divisions of race and ethnicity and language and caste and class and even divisions among civilizations that people talk about, the one thing that is true across all these groups is that people care about their kids. And they actually want more or less the same thing for their kids. They want, when you ask the parents, they say, well, we'd like a world, a future in which these children are safe and secure, and in which our children can flourish as human beings. And they use slightly different language depending on their cultures, but it's basically the same. Now, if we can agree on those things across all of these societies, on this fundamental point, we have the basis for creating a common sense of community that will allow us to address problems like energy and climate, and most fundamentally, the problems of equity we have on this planet. We're not going to start making some of these difficult choices about who's going to give up what and how wealth and resources might be transferred from one place to another unless we start realizing that we're all part of one community. Now, I think that's possible. but we have to remember our children. And if we do, I think it's conceivable that in 100 or 120 years from now, we'll live on a substantially warmer planet with perhaps a loss of something like 30% of the planet's biodiversity and coastlines that are receding. But we will actually have reached an agreement among all of us, the silver lining, in a sense, of climate change. That will mean that we're living in a more prosperous world, by some definitions, and a more humane world, certainly, and a world in which our children and grandchildren can flourish as we have been able to. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for this very thought-provoking opening speech of our conference. I think you made a tour d'horizon about all the issues we will have to deal with the next 2 days. Thomas Homer Dixon is ready to take some questions and observations. So if you have, I hope we have a microphone in the room. If not, you have to speak up very loud. There's the microphone in the center. Who makes the... John, would you like to join us?
And come on, you're like one of my classes.
I'm certain that there are many provocative things that I said, and there will be. Can we turn off my lapel mic, please?
Maybe I start with a question, because looking at both presentations, there seemed to be one common reference, which is the armament race, the 60s, or the Cold War scenario, and there might be a difference in the evaluation of the power of democracy in solving the climate crisis. John was talking about the power of a central committee of the Chinese Communist Party compared to the long procedures, stalemates, etc., in parliamentarian democracies. And you were telling us about a open architecture democracy. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on what you mean with open architecture democracy, and maybe you could point to some first signs or observations concerning the emergence of forms of democracy. Because you're conclusion might be very surprising and provocative to many that climate change needs more democracy, not less democracy.
Well, it's a terrific question. I'm led to this conclusion because of a fundamental reality in our world, which is that power of all kinds is shifting down the social hierarchy, away from large institutions to individuals. And it's largely driven by technological change. A laptop computer, we don't have one visible here, but a standard laptop computer has about as much computational power as was available to the entire American Defense Department in the 1960s. In those days, it would have filled a building, that computer would have filled a building about the size of this building. I always check before I come in, just to make sure I can say that. And now it's in a box about the size of about 4 liters in volume, available to hundreds of millions of people around the world, giving them, as I mentioned earlier on, at the beginning of my presentation, absolutely astonishing analytical capability, information gathering capability, and communicative capability, for better or for worse. That genie can't be put back in the bottle. And any kind of governance process in the future is going to have to incorporate those very powerful citizens and individuals into governance. Now, what's happening, unfortunately, with a lot of this technology is it's just allowing for that kind of cacophony of narcissism that I was talking about before, the kind of focus on a narrow community, say a Facebook community or a MySpace community, Instead, what we need to do is try to create situations in which these technologies allow people to connect and mobilize around political issues. Now, examples. It's just a beginning, but I was really struck by how Barack Obama used the internet in his campaign. And as one of my colleagues pointed out to me, Barack Obama is the first president of the United States since the 1950s, since Eisenhower, is not beholden to powerful economic interests. Because, among other things, he raised most of his money, $20, $50, $100 at a time, and he was able to do that because of the internet. When he runs into political obstacles in the United States, in Congress, he's not only going out and making speeches, he's firing up that apparatus that he helped develop during his campaign and using it in the background. We don't hear a lot about it, but there's a constant process of political action and mobilization that he's engaged in to try to push his policies forward. That was an invigorating thing in the United States. There were very substantial numbers of people, especially young people, who came out to engage in the democratic process who would never have been engaged in the absence of that technology. Now, the open architecture, the open source movement, has learned a lot of things about what works and what doesn't work if you want to create voluntaristic problem-solving communities and avoid those problems of hijacking and of experts dominating the conversation to create the winnowing process and the accumulation I was talking about. A lot of those things have been learned, but there's been very little practical discussion about how those lessons would be applied to democratic practice. I think it's an enormous research problem, and it's a very urgent one, because in the absence of that kind of mobilization, you're not going to be able to move these special interests aside. And let's remember, that's exactly the political program that Barack Obama has engaged in the United States. He's using that democratic mobilization to push aside as best as possible the special interests that are blocking healthcare reform, that are blocking, ultimately, when he engages in this battle, climate change policy too.
Thank you. There must be a yes but in the room.
There's a question back there.
Yeah, please.
I'm Dagmar Dehmer from the Tagesspiegel in Berlin, the daily newspaper in Berlin. I would like to ask you, for some clarification too. I did not really understand what a steady state economy might be.
Fair enough. It's an economy that doesn't grow. Now, you might define what growth is in various ways. You might try to define it in non-material ways and say we can have growth, but it's non-material growth. In other words, there's no increased consumption of resources over time or increased consumption of energy. For a variety of reasons, I concluded that that's a false hope, and that ultimately what we need to achieve on the planet is an economy where we have static and ultimately declining material and energy throughput, so that over time, in terms of its load on the natural environment, it's getting smaller. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that people will live worse off, but this then links immediately to the last point I was making about the normative transition, because the evolution of a steady-state global economy is going to depend fundamentally on changes in people's perception of the good life. As long as we, in North America, for instance, and we'll speak for Europeans, but conceive of the good life as one involving 5-bedroom houses, 3-car garages, and a Hummer in the driveway, we are not going to be able to solve this problem. If people can start to recognize over time that actually above a certain threshold, increased income doesn't actually make them much happier and might actually make them less happy, then they can start thinking about alternative ways that they might be happy, alternative notions of the good life. But that's a values discussion that's deeply embedded in this larger conversation about the nature of our economy. The last thing I'll say on this is that the World Bank World Development Report usually suggests that we need somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3% economic growth in real terms every year through this century. Well, we have a $70 trillion world economy right now. That kind of growth rate will quadruple the size of the world economy in real dollars, in today's dollars, in 50, 60 years. So from $70 trillion to $300 trillion. It's not going to happen. Even with dramatic improvements in energy and material efficiency, we would still probably see, at that growth rate, we would probably still see increases in energy use and material use of somewhere between 1 and 2% a year. So we would probably double our resource consumption in that 50 to 60 year period on the surface of the planet, and ultimately our waste output. We're already straining the global biosphere, the global ecology and climate system extraordinarily severely with an economy of $70 trillion. So this is why I say in my presentation, we're going to see an end to economic growth this century. It's either going to be voluntary or involuntary. If it's involuntary, it will happen because we see systemic collapses of various kinds. Major food shortfalls in parts of the world because of climate change, energy shortages. Or we can choose to go a different route, but it brings us face to face with the equity problems I identified, the problems of the gap between rich and poor on this planet. And that issue is never raised in discussions of climate change, or very rarely raised.
There's one question here.
Okay, now we're off.
Handelsblatt newspaper here in Düsseldorf. My question was, do you see any political force in that way? A force that would lead to a steady state economy?
No. Well, I said I'd raise some issues. I don't have all the answers. Those four equivalencies I was talking about are extremely powerful and persuasive. I mean, Benjamin Friedman wrote a whole book 3 years ago on the equation between growth and freedom. It was titled something like The Moral Case for Economic Growth. And while I disagree with a lot of it, I can't dismiss a lot of it too. We are really in a difficult bind here. We have an economic system that, and a social system more generally, that in order to stay stable, in particular politically stable, has to grow and has to ultimately consume more and more resources. And yet we're now starting to reach the limits of the size of the human economy relative to the size of the planet's biosphere and resource system. And it's a really deep contradiction. I would like to see, you know, some investment, not just in, say, in North America, corn-based ethanol or, you know, carbon capture and storage, which I happen to think is a very important technology, or whatever we happen to be investing our enormous research and R&D dollars in right at the moment. I'd like to see a substantial investment in trying to figure out how we can live on this planet with a steady state economy without being at each other's throats. I'm not sure how it will be done. But we have some idea of the technical aspects of it. People like Herman Daly have worked on this a lot. But in terms of the social and political and ethical implications of steady state, people have not thought that through for the most part.
Okay, let's take two more questions. One is here and one is over there.
Hello, I'm Stefan Björklund. I'm a Swedish citizen. From 1970s until mid of 90s, Sweden had a very low economic growth. And also Germany, after the reunification, have had more than a decade of very low economic growth. Both these countries have expanded the public sector, so they have got a very big bloated public sector, wasting a lot of money, and therefore the economy has stagnated. So we have had managed already low growth. Britain, I was also living in Britain some years, I could see under the Blair government, they expanded the public sector, particularly in the NHS, with a lot of bureaucrats and also in local councils. And now Britain are heading for a period over many years, I think, of very low growth. Do you think if we are sitting here, most people I think here is already paid for by public money. Do you think it would be a nice idea to grow the public sector so you create enormous bureaucracies? I remember, for example, I was on a climate conference in Sundsvall, Sweden, 1990. It was about 300 participants. I was in Berlin, 1995, about 5,000. I was in Bali 1.5 years ago. I think it was 15,000 people. And I expect in Copenhagen there will be no hotel rooms on the whole island of Shetland. I think it will come probably 50,000 people. Okay. If you make an exponent, exponential rise.
We get the picture.
Yes, you understand.
I understand. Okay. And it's a good point. And actually, it allows me to, I think, add a very important addendum to my comments. It's essential that a steady state economy not be an uninnovative economy. You don't want it to stagnate because the problems that humankind is facing aren't going to go away. We're going to need an enormous rate of innovation in response to those problems. And to the extent that an economy and a society has to bear the dead weight of huge bureaucracies severe regulations or whatever, you actually have lower rates of innovation. So there's a very difficult conundrum here. Because what normally happens in economies is that innovation contributes to economic growth, increases economic productivity, and allows everybody to live better off. The major source of economic growth over the last several centuries has been technological innovation. We need the technological innovation, all kinds of innovation, not just technological, but also social innovation, but without the growth. At least growth in material and energy consumption, which is the way we usually define the way we normally define growth has inevitably the implication of growing material and energy consumption. So we need the innovation, but not the growth, and it's not clear how we get there.
Last question is over there.
Yes, thank you. My name is Anita Engels from University of Hamburg. Thank you for your lecture. Well, it seems that the complexity is very crucial in your talk, and my experience as a teacher at the university is that people are just not prepared to face complexity, to deal with it. When we organize public lectures on climate change and society, people come there and they are extremely concerned, they are willing to learn, but they are not able to deal with the kinds of complexities that you, as I understood it, said that we have to face, and that's reinforcing my own research in an important way. I find the same kind of difficulties when I talk with many colleagues from the natural scientists, that vis-a-vis all these complexities, that they tend to adopt very technocratic solutions. And so my question is, you make a huge point of democracy, and in a democracy, of course, political programs have to be sold, and complexity doesn't really sell. So what can we do about complexity and preparing people to be able to live with complexity?
It's a really good question. It's a great one to finish on, and it's another one of these situations where I'm not sure entirely of the answer. I think it's a reality we live in a complex world. It may also be a reality, as you imply, although I'm not sure I agree, that the, human brains just aren't very good at coping with complexity, and so we shy away from it in various ways. We look for, when faced with a complex problem, a silver bullet of some kind, a simple solution, something that will just take care of it. We hope if we're faced with a complex problem that a leader will come along who will just clear it up for us so we don't have to worry. But I'm not so convinced. I think that, and this is why I thought it was relevant to raise this in a conference on cultural transformation, because I think that it is possible for people to shift their way of seeing the world. They may be resistant as much because it's something new as because you're trying to talk about complexity. And it may be, as much as anything, an educational matter. And and that starts perhaps right at the level of the first step into an educational institution, what we would call, say, junior kindergarten or kindergarten in North America, all the way up through university. In the lessons that are taught, the toys that children have. And I think, you know something, I think that there's evidence that people can understand this kind of thing, because I think in some intuitive way, many of our ancestors understood this. They got the point. They realized they lived in a world of unknown unknowns, that there were a lot of things they didn't understand. The idea that we could engineer nature, engineer our societies, manage everything precisely, is really a very modern conception in many respects, and wasn't true in earlier centuries. We've become enamored of our own progress, our scientific ability, our capacity to control the things around us, and we've convinced ourselves that we can do it, in many cases, for all things and all systems. We haven't realized the limit of that capacity. So I think that you can communicate to the general public the basic intuitive notions of complexity, the importance of prudence. I don't know whether this will communicate very well to a German audience, but I say in North America that I'll know I'm making some progress when people start naming their little girls Prudence again. Now, in North America, that would be a terrible thing to do to a little girl. We live in a bungee jumping culture. We think we can estimate exactly when our skull is going to miss the ground, you know, we'll keep it 3 centimeters above the ground. But it turns out that many of the systems aren't so calculable and so easily estimated in terms of their consequences. We need to have the ability, the public needs to have the street sense, in a sense, for being able to distinguish between those situations where a mechanistic approach applies and a complex systems approach might, is a better one to use. Now, the final thing I'll say is that in terms of the capacity of the public to understand these issues, I write books for general audiences. I've written several of them, and they've sold quite well. The last one had 100 pages of endnotes and 3,000 citations. And you wouldn't believe the number of people I get coming up to me saying, thank you for putting that material in, because it allows me to educate myself, to go to the web, to pursue those resources and learn more. It also allows me to see how you got to your conclusions. That's a matter, you see, I see democracy as respect. Democracy is a process of respecting people to learn and make up their own decisions and make up their own minds and make their decisions. And honestly, to come back to the point I made earlier, we actually don't have a choice. There's so much power out there now. The hierarchy is now so flat that we just have to hope that democracy will work, because at this point, hierarchies and technocratic decision-making doesn't have a hope, because it won't be legitimate. People won't go along with it, and they'll have the power to oppose it if they don't agree. They have to be part of the process. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for this terrific lecture. I have 3 very short final remarks. Number one is, don't think we are a bunch of male chauvinists. If you look at the program, you will find a male dominance, to say the least. Please believe it's not because we are male chauvinists. We usually make sure that we have a sound balance, gender balance, in our conference, but this time we really had bad luck. From long-term commitments of those who were invited to last-minute cancellations, okay, this is the problem we had. Please believe it's really, we take our apologies for that and be as gender-blind as you can be for the next 2 days. 2, we will continue tomorrow morning, not in this room, but in the Festsaal. This is at the southern end of this building. You will find signs for the Festsaal tomorrow morning at 9, and we will continue with discussions about the economy of climate change. First keynote speaker will be Ottmar Edenhofer from the Potsdam Institute. And 3 is, you are now all men and women invited for a drink at this bar vis-a-vis this room, and I hope to see you well tomorrow morning. As we say in Essen, Glück auf. Thank you very much.
Thank you.